Spencer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is, in my opinion, the most qualified scientist to be studying the events of 9/11. She has degrees in structural engineering, in engineering mechanics and materials engineering science. She's a former professor of mechanical engineering. She's published over 60 peer-reviewed articles. She was denied tenure, it appears, for doing research on 9/11, which is a shame and a disgrace to the university that would not respect academic freedom and the importance of scholars becoming involved in issues of great importance to the community, in this case of transcendent significance. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show once again Judy Wood. Judy, welcome to the Dynamic Duo.
Hey, thanks.
We have had a most interesting week. There have been a couple of developments I want to mention and just get your reaction to them. Of course, yesterday I had the great pleasure of having Ace Baker as my special guest, and we visited his website, and he showed us a sequence of about 7 or 8 frames from the video showing United Flight 175 hitting the South Tower, purportedly. And the point he made was, you know, you see all these frames of the plane going into the building, and then he juxtaposed it against a frame showing the cutout in the building. And the point he made is that the cutout in the building isn't present when the plane is entering the building and presumably creating it, which means that the video has to be a fake, which is just stunning, absolutely stunning stuff. I mean, you can't have the cause of the effect and not bring about the effects that it would be bringing about at the very time it was in operation, and have them only show up later, which would mean they'd have to be the result of some other process than the one that was purported to produce them. So I love this. I think it's absolutely fascinating. To me, it's the most conclusive argument yet we have a video fakery, Judy. What's your take?
Same thing, and I've looked at those pictures and say that it reminds me of first and 10 technology where they use in football. And if you look carefully, the yellow line they draw across the field where under the guy's jersey, it becomes a little hazy right there.
Yeah.
And just like when the plane is near the building, it starts to disappear, it goes hazy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I've suggested to him that what he wants to do is to juxtapose the frame, you know, showing the plane disappearing into the building with a frame that shows the enormous hole in the building, just to show what it should have looked like if it were authentic, in addition to what he already has. But I love his work. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And it's really just stunning to me how a man of the sophistication intelligence of an Anthony Lawson is just going hammers and tongs after in this case, the September Clues series, which he's seeking to debunk. I don't know. It's interesting that he's at least committed himself to a speed from the aircraft in the video as at 572 miles an hour, because if it turns out, as I am confident in believing now, that that's aerodynamically impossible at that altitude, then, of course, at the very least, there's a definite commitment he has made that will be clearly falsified, and I believe indeed has already been shown to be false by the engineer who was working for Boeing, who designed the shaker system, who said the plane would start to fall apart at 220 miles an hour at that altitude and couldn't possibly exceed 330.
Jim, as you know, I like to empower the student, because we're all students, and we don't need to look up to any particular person to tell us the answer if we can figure it out ourselves.
Yes.
And I have a few mental exercises I would like the listeners to go through. One of them is, answer this question. Why are you required to fasten seatbelts when you go through turbulence?
Yeah, go ahead. Why are you required to fasten your seatbelts during turbulence? Go ahead.
Fasten seatbelt sign is on, right?
Yeah.
And they don't serve coffee then, because the coffee would not be moving the same as the airplane. If the airplane, what is turbulence? Well, you have denser air, less dense air, and if it jogs that plane around so easily, just by a little tiny change in air density, what's the building going to do?
Oh, I like that, too. Yeah, I like that a lot. That's very, very good.
And NIST and various others who just on the quote official story like to say that the airplane, Greg Jenkins went through a big argument on this, that there's no way the plane needs to slow down. Well, why does it slow down in thicker air? And why do airplanes fly around storm systems? Time is money. Money is time. It's going to store fuel. You're going to be late arriving.
Right. And if they would put up no more resistance than, say, a twin tower, Judy, the absurdity of this, becomes more and more manifest. I mean, it's embarrassing to me for those people who have been so critical and standoffish, not been willing to look, because the evidence is, in my judgment now, conclusive that video fakery was taking place. Conclusive.
We don't need to know how they did it, but the story of an airplane doing that makes no sense.
Yes. You're cutting in and out just a little bit. I don't know if you want to stay a more constant distance from your phone.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's
been another event that I found of equal fascination, which is that George Washington, Alex Sloan, put up a blog talking about how some 14 million gallons of water had been dumped on the World Trade Center. And he also said how thermite can continue to burn underwater. But, it's like, there's a phrase that's very familiar to adults, a quickie. I mean, thermite's a quickie. We're talking about 14 million gallons, and we're talking about a pools of molten metal that are supposed to have persisted for weeks, if not even months. It's preposterous to suppose you could have vast pools of molten metal persisting for weeks or months when you've had 14 million gallons of water poured on them.
Well, when the towers went poof, it broke one of the water mains in West Street, and West Street turned into sort of a lake. And there's pictures of the firemen walking, wading through there like ankle deep.
Right.
They weren't boiling. There wasn't steam coming out of the water.
Right, absolutely right. And, by the way, I'm convinced now that the explosions in the sub-basements just before the planes hit were to take out the water sprinkler system to bring all the water down. William Rodriguez, who visited here a couple weeks ago, and I discussed this, and he said there was water everywhere.
That was in the South Tower. The South Tower, something happened, and all the water drained, because the water's up from up above, it drained out of the system. And those videos we see of the stuff pouring out the window, we don't know what it is, and we know that NIST acknowledges they colorize it and it changes the intensity, whatever that means. Whether they change the hue of it or brighten it or brighten these pixels and not those pixels, they acknowledge that it's tampered with.
Really?
And this is in that article that Morgan Reynolds and I did over a year ago in August.
Yeah.
Why indeed did the towers disintegrate?
Right.
And we have the pictures in there. It shows in their caption, intensities have been intensified. and you look at it, and it's a bright, crisp orange line, right by the edge.
I can't believe how these people can, argue their case using falsified evidence that's acknowledged as such with a straight face. How can they do it? It's beyond me. And how can anyone imagine you could have 14 million gallons of water poured on vast pools of molten metal and not have enormous steam explosions? I mean, this is so simple. This is so elementary that it stuns me that anyone should be persisting in maintaining that there were vast pools of molten metal. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest, Judy Wood, the former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, who is, in my judgment, the leading scientific expert on the events of 9/11, in particular at the World Trade Center, probably because she is. Judy, it's a great pleasure to have you back. I don't know what to say about these guys who are so committed to the integrity of the video that when they're confronted with such a devastating and simple disproof as Ace Baker has provided, or those who are committed to this vast pool of molten metal, when they're confronted with a simple and powerful disproof, even advanced by Alex Sloan, no less. I mean, Judy, this has got to be embarrassing to those guys.
There's some interesting things going on lately. Like something jacking for position. This is like an orchestra being played almost. But what I like to look at is the evidence and just focus on the evidence. But sometimes I get some clues by looking at What's the opposition attacking so vehemently? Ah, that must be. I must be right. Yeah. It's a way of holding a scorecard just internally to get a sense for if it's going the right way or not. What's interesting is, you know, who is attacked the most on the internet in for 9/11 truth?
Well, I think you have that honor.
Why would folks find it so important to attack me instead of find out what happened on 9/11?
Well, it's real funny, isn't it, Judy? You know, Jack White, a longtime colleague of mine in JFK research, and who is now doing some excellent work on 9/11, told me long ago that he had developed the principle based on a history of attacks that the more they attack you, the greater the probability that you're onto something important. So I think that principle carries over here with no doubt.
I saw in a forum yesterday where they started a new policy. Anyone who promoted anything to do with Judy Wood was banned.
You're kidding me.
And I thought, all right, I have arrived.
Which forum was that?
I won't advertise for them.
Right. These people are know-nothings. You know, this is an ostrich policy. This is burying your head in the sand. This is ignoring the evidence. This is playing the role of a buffoon. These people are saps and suckers for the government, or worse, of course, Judy, or worse.
But what I'm seeing is there's an awful lot of fear going on out there, but something else is changing. I think folks, I'm just speaking openly here, I think folks are beginning to realize what deep trouble we're in. And they're realizing, I believe, they were led down a dead-end street. And they're going, whoa, and we don't have much time to get back.
Well, it's fascinating because, you know, the majority of those in the research community who are trying to steer this ship are going to avoid, you know, video fakery. They're going to avoid all of your research. And here we have two very simple, very elegant disproofs of key pillars of their position, to wit, a disproof of the authenticity of the videos and a disproof of the existence of vast pools of molten metal, because we know, after all, there were 14 million gallons of water. There's no doubt about that. And if there also were those vast pools of molten metal, there would have been huge steam explosions, enormous, uncontrollable.
Let's do another mental exercise. I think what we've all been taught since we were young, that if you cook something in hot oil on the stove and you end up with a grease fire,
yeah,
you don't put water on it.
Yeah.
You throw a flour on it or something to smother, but you do not put water on it.
That's
Why
right.
is that?
Well, because you'll create these steam explosions.
Right. Water expands by a factor of 1,600.
Yeah, that's studied.
In volume.
1,600. People have to think about that.
And so that's how pressure cookers work.
By the way, Judy, you know, this is an aside, but mentioning that point, it has therefore seemed to me that one way to bring about this pulverization could be a process that causes water to expand, you know, by 1,600 times. I mean, what would that do to human bodies, which are close to 90% water?
That's if it's done with heat.
Aha. Uh-huh.
We saw people running down the street.
Right.
I was chasing him. Remember that famous picture of the guy with his mouth open in panic running down VC Street?
Yeah.
The cloud chasing him. After the cloud passed, you saw people covered in white dust.
Right.
You didn't see cooked bodies.
That's right.
We saw no cooked bodies.
That's right. So, yeah, so it can't be a steam cloud.
And we've been going over various testimonies, and there's one or a couple of them we've seen now where they've described even that the cloud is being cooler than the ambient temperature. That's kind of interesting. A couple of the first responders. I forgot the name of the book. Morgan's reading it.
Could you repeat that point, Judy?
The first responder, when the cloud came over them, they said it was cooler than ambient temperature.
The cloud was cooler? Oh,
yes.
That's fascinating.
And this is interesting that they had noted it. And this was a surgeon for the New York City Police Department. I didn't realize they have their special surgery department.
Uh-huh.
This particular guy even ended up injured with a broken back afterwards. But, you know, he was right there and was trapped and stuff. And was talking about how the cloud was cooler. And I thought that was very interesting. And if people, if something was burned, maybe it was like an acid burn.
And two, you recall Frank Morales, who was among the very first on the scene, an Episcopal priest who was there to perform the last rites, said not only was there not a pile of debris, but actually where the Twin Towers had been, there were enormous pits that actually it was below surface level, which is utterly fascinating, too.
There's various other interesting comments from first responders. You remember that cluster of firemen who were trapped in Stairwell B?
Yeah.
And this one fellow who went on the Montel Williams show, and also it's in the firefighter transcripts, that he described when they first got out of that hole after being in there for 4 hours, he said it was like walking out onto an empty football field. Like, where's the buildings?
Walking out onto an empty football field, that's fascinating, too.
And there's another testimony of two firemen who went from both the towers were burning. They went out the base of Tower 2 and went into Tower 1. They didn't realize that Tower 2 went poof. And when they came back out, the door they went in, they said, wait a minute, we came in the wrong door. Because there's no building there.
Isn't that stunning? Now you see it, now you don't. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Judy Wood. We'll be right back. My special guest today is Judy Wood, the most qualified scientist to be studying the events of 9/11, in particular at the World Trade Center. Judy, you know, I'm reminded of this principle that Dave Von Kleist enunciated with great force at the conference, to wit, if an honest man is shown evidence that proves that he's wrong, he will either change his mind or cease being honest. And it seems to me we have now proofs of such elegance, such simplicity, as to be incontrovertible, and that they're going to pose, you know, challenge to Dave Von Kleist on the one hand about the authenticity of the videos, and I dare say even scholars as eminent as David Ray Griffin about the existence of the molten metal. So don't you think they're in a bit of a quandary?
I prefer to look at information that will help our listeners, which is let's use our senses. The media and controllers and manipulators of have been telling us how to interpret what we see. You don't really see what you see. How many times have you heard that we all know what we saw on the TV? Live TV, as though that proves it's a fact. And that was repeated on the TV many times. This is live TV.
Yeah.
How can it be, is that kind of a contradiction?
Oh, I love it. And how can an Alex Flom, acknowledge that there were 14 million gallons of water poured on the World Trade Center and still insist that there was molten metal and try to justify it on the grounds that thermite can burn underwater? I mean, okay, it can burn underwater for what, 10 seconds maybe? I mean, that would be 10 seconds. That's all you'd get out of the thermite.
Yeah.
It burns so fast.
I don't really want to get into, who said what, but there are people who are very adamant about keeping the molten metal story alive. And,
yeah.
And what I would like for folks to ask is, why is it so important to them? Why are they hanging on to it like it's their long-lost teddy bear?
Do you want me to take a stab at it?
I'd like to take a stab at it.
Take a stab at it, Judy.
What does that imply? It implies that everything we're told is a lie. And you have to give up the spoon-fed story that the media gave us.
You mean if there is no molten metal, then what we've been told is a lie?
Yeah, and if there is no molten metal, what is that fuming coming out of the ground?
Right, which is supposed to be the fumes, the smoke, or even steam. But, of course, we know on rainy days it isn't there.
And also the workers stand right in the middle of it.
The workers stand in the middle of it, and they aren't scalded like the poor fellow who drove his pickup truck into that steam pipe explosion in New York City was scalded over 80% of his body with third-degree burns.
And again, let's look at what every one of us knows. I think everyone's been to a restaurant where you have steamed clams or steamed food. Your food gets cooked when it is steamed. Why aren't people cooked if they're steamed?
That's right.
That means that can't be steamed, what we saw at Ground Zero.
That's not a pleasant way to go either, by the way.
Right, yeah. I'm so sorry for frogs and, clams and what get dropped in the hot water.
Lobsters even. So those are really being boiled rather than steamed.
But
yeah.
There's been like a magic trick that's been performed on our country and on the world. How do we know who's telling us the truth?
Yeah.
I don't want people to believe anyone. I want them to be able to think for themselves.
Yeah.
What did they see? What did they hear? Not what, you know, how does a magician work?
Yeah, but it's part of your gift, Judy. And listen, you are gifted to be able to, you know, look at these things and recognize that it's not necessarily what would be subsumed by conventional concepts. I mean, you see a stuff coming up and it looks sort of smokish-like, and to realize it can be wispy and all that, and it's not necessarily got the origin that would have to have if it were smoke or if it were steam or what have you. So that you really require us to look afresh at something we maybe previously thought we understood.
Right, and that's why I give it a new name, so that we don't mislead ourselves.
I know, and would you believe some of your critics out there, you don't want to say when you talk about the fuzzy balls, you know, or the fuming and all that, that you're just sort of being naive, when in fact it's the ultimate in sophistication.
I could call it event 27-3A, event that 98117.
Judy, listen, I do a lot of work in the philosophy of mind and the nature of cognition and when concepts subsume experience, that's when perception takes place. And what you're doing is encouraging us not to be too hasty by subsuming experience by means of familiar concepts, when what we may need are unfamiliar concepts that fit this experience.
And when we notice, you know, so many articles, so many people repeat as though it's given. Well, when the planes hit the buildings, wait a minute, that's an assumption you're making. You know, are you going to say the story is wrong about point A, it's wrong about point B, it's wrong about point C, point D, point E? Ah, but I absolutely know I don't even need to look. It must be right about F.
Yeah.
It's like we're told the planes hit the buildings. We think that's what we saw on TV, where we're led to believe that.
Yeah.
But I think we should question everything. But after all, we see Star Trek on TV.
Yeah.
In sci-fi, we also go to magic shows. But we know we're at a magic show.
Well, there's no end. I mean, we're exposed to such a vast panoply of special effects during our lifetimes, you know, tens of thousands of hours spent watching movies and videos that involve fakery. I think it lulls us, it numbs us into a kind of a false sense of willingness to believe almost anything.
And that's right. We see Hollywood, and things are really fantastic that we see on the TV or in the movies. So what was pulled on 9/11 had to top that. That's a tall order. The shock and awe, in order to have shock and awe, had to be over the top. It had to outdo Hollywood.
That's fascinating, Judy. That's really good.
Because you had to catch people off guard.
Yeah, this is not merely King Kong. This is not merely the White House blowing to pieces. This is really stunning stuff. I think that's really quite a remarkable insight, you know, about the degree to which they had to, the extent to which they had to go to get the degree of psychological surprise, induce a kind of numbness, the real shock and awe effect. And of course, they studied shock and awe. They told us when they hit Baghdad how all this was purposeful. It was a psychological operation, shock and awe. And what they just didn't happen to mention is just like we pulled on 9/11.
Yeah, shock and awe is the way to go. I think there's a book, I forgot who it's by, called The Shock Doctrine.
Yeah.
That's an interesting book that talks about that. And also, if you shock people or scare them, they're likely to just follow your order. People shut down on various other, like, secondary thinking, and they go into survival mode. For example, when the police yell, "Get down on the ground, get down on the ground," people immediately get down on the ground. They're not going to say, "What do you want me to get down on the ground for?"
Yeah.
No, they just do what they're told.
Yeah.
So if you shock people, that's why the police yell, because then people do it.
Yeah, well.
So there's other things, too. When people go into their emergency mode, panic mode, they shut off extra thinking, and they just do what's in front of them. And you can pull a lot of tricks on them, a lot of tricks on a lot of people. And it's, look how long it's taken to peel down through these layers. It's being able to peel back those images that we had imprinted on in our brains. So
I think you're absolutely right.
And so let's, you know, when we look at the images, what do we see? What do we smell? What do we hear? Not what we're told we're supposed to feel or hear or see.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Judy Wood, former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, and we're talking about recent research, including Ace Baker's disproof of the authenticity of a video of United Airlines Flight 175 hitting the South Tower, which is so beautiful and so elegant that I cannot understand how any rational mind is going to be able to resist it. And then, of course, the bizarre Alex Flom post on George Washington, where he acknowledges that 14,000 gallons of water were dumped on the World Trade Center debris, and yet still insists that there was massive pools of molten metal, defending that position on the ground that thermite can burn underwater. But as I was pointing out before, thermite's a quickie. This would only last about 10 or 15 seconds, and then we got weeks, if not months, that molten metal's supposed to be there, which obviously would have gone up in an enormous steam explosion had it encountered 14 million gallons of water. Judy, I can't understand how Alex Flom can even post such a thing and not realize he's making himself look like a complete and total idiot.
I don't like to spend my time on
I know you don't.
I'd rather be figuring out what's going on. There's some clues there that, you know, for some reason he gets turned on by that. So, you know, whatever floats your boat. I did see the that post. I looked at it. What interested me, he gave a link to a book that it's named 9 Months at Ground Zero.
Yes.
And it's more testimony of people who were there. And okay, that interested me. So I went and looked at that. And there was an interesting quote by one of the workers there. He said, "Everything was one color. Some of it was wet, some of it was dry. Don't forget, they hose the site down constantly for dust suppression."
Dust suppression.
Yeah. The longer we were there and the deeper we got in the pile, the debris almost looked like topsoil.
The debris almost looked like topsoil.
Potting soil? Everything was covered with gray dust and dirt. I thought that was fascinating. A rescue worker said this, and this was from a link in George Washington's post.
Yeah.
He quoted that link, but he took out some of the words. He took out "for dust suppression."
Oh, really?
And then he added on a comment to make you think that it was being hosed down with water for fire suppression.
Really?
But
that's a no-no. This guy's a lawyer. He's supposed to know better than that.
It's like, well, I wonder why he did that. But I found that post fascinating. It's really cool that he's linked to the actual source.
Uh-huh.
So this is a rescue worker or a Ground Zero worker who's acknowledging that the water was used for dust suppression.
Yes.
And also that you got more and more dirt as time went on. I'd like to read one of my favorite statements in my appeal to NIST.
Yeah, please do.
I show a picture at Ground Zero that's taken 2 days after 9/11. And it's right at the plaza level, which is level, no building there, and there's clumps of dirt all over the place. And I say the WTC plaza level had been covered with cement blocks before 9/11. And in the above photo, dated 9/13/01, shows it covered with dirt. A collapse does not cause a building to turn into dirt. And ARA should know this. ARA, Applied Research Associates, was the company hired by, one of the companies hired by NIST to help prepare the analysis for their report of the World Trade Center. And ARA, they have a contract with the government to know everything about anything to do with any weapon of mass destruction on the planet. They should know how a building turned into a pile of dirt.
How a building can turn into a pile of dirt.
And there's dirt there.
And how many hundreds of truckloads of dirt did Giuliani have brought into the site?
He spoke on the 12th, the morning of the 12th, Wednesday, September 12th, 2001, and bragged about 120 dump trucks coming and going in the, overnight. And he said that it was taking out debris, but if you're going to look for survivors, you're not going to disturb the rubble pile. You know, like, you remember the game Pick Up Sticks?
Yeah.
And see how many sticks you can pull out before everything crashes?
Right, right, right. And remember how he's diverting attention by talking about what they were taking out and not mentioning what they're bringing in.
The story was, the way I hear it, is that he's saying dump trucks came and went all night long. Don't worry about it if you saw them. Don't worry about what was coming or going.
Uh-huh.
But the dirt has continued to come and go.
Yes.
I was there a week or two ago, and would you believe they're still hauling dirt in and out?
Judy, this is stunning stuff. I mean, you know, that they still, and I gather they're still wearing sophisticated masks on the cleanup scene.
I guess some people say that. They're wearing, hazmat suits, rubber hazmat suits on a clear blue sky day. No cloud in the sky, 75 degrees out.
I mean, this is blatant. This means something happened there that is completely beyond the bounds of the normal. I mean, there's no way conventional explosives could yield a result where you need to be wearing these rubber masks and suits all these years later. Years later. We're talking years later.
I'll be posting these images in the next few days, and it's rather shocking. And when we got there, there's a few of us were visiting there, and we're looking through the fence. And there's this huge pile of dirt. The dirt is like one story high above ground. Big, nice potting soil, nice rich dirt. And I visited the same place 3 days later, and now there's kind of a hole in the ground. The dirt has been moved out. And then we saw dirt trucks hauling the dirt out. Let me ask you this. What is the story for why they haven't built on Ground Zero yet?
Well, that's a good question. Of course, they had all the competition, you know. They had to decide what they were going to structure, they were going to build. But I think they finally resolved that, even though it was fraught with controversy.
What are they going to build there?
When are they going to build there?
What are they going to build there?
What are they going to build there? Well, I had the impression it was going to be this Freedom Tower that was kind of a monument, you know, to the events of 9/11 and a couple of other subsidiary buildings that were also enormous structures.
Why is there a brand new dirt pile on bedrock? Manhattan is bedrock.
Yes.
And we saw the bathtub carved out down to bedrock.
Yes.
All the debris hauled away. So why is there this pile of dirt there? Why do you put a huge pile of dirt there before you build the building?
Well, I'd say it must be still suffering from residual contamination of one kind or another.
And that isn't that shocking that that's going on right in front of us.
And how anyone could reconcile that with conventional explosives or modes of demolition is beyond me, Judy. I mean, this is another very telling indication that even the side of the critics who claim it was done by the government but using conventional explosives cannot be the whole story. It just can't be. This is ridiculous.
There's so many ways to destroy that story, like, you know, how fast the buildings went away.
Yes.
How they didn't hit the ground hard enough.
Yes.
The ground only rumbled for 8 seconds.
Yeah.
In a vacuum, it takes 9.5 seconds to drop a bowling ball off the roof.
That's right. In a vacuum.
There's so many things to this that just don't add up.
Judy, I want to thank you for coming on today. As you know, the second hour, we're going to have Jerry Leiphart visit with us. And I just want to thank you for your ongoing research, which is cutting edge. And I say, and I repeat, I said yesterday, and I repeat, if anyone wants to know what's going on in 9/11 research, they better tune into the dynamic duo, because you're not going to learn it anywhere else. This is Jim Fetzer thanking my special guest, Judy Wood, and inviting everyone to stand by for the second half of our show with Jerry Leiphart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest for the second hour is an activist civil rights trial lawyer and a bar member in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. He has more than 33 years' experience as a lawyer in both domestic and international areas. He was the moving force behind the use of the Data Quality Act to submit requests for correction to the NIST, which, in my opinion, is eventually going to lead to the shattering of the 9/11 cover-up under the law. And today we're going to be talking about some efforts of the House to pass thought crimes legislation. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the dynamic duo Jerry Liebhardt. Jerry, welcome.
Well, thanks, Jim. Be here as usual. The topic that you've indicated will be discussed tonight, I think, is an important one.
Well, that's kind of scary, and I was noticing that there was a precedent for it in August that the president signed an executive order on Lebanon criminalizing dissent. It was entitled Blocking Property of Persons Undermining the Sovereignty of Lebanon or Its Democratic Process, and the key provision says, any person determined by the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with the Secretary of State to have taken or to pose a significant risk of taking actions, including acts of violence that have the purpose or effect of undermining Lebanon's democratic processes or institutions, contributing to the breakdown of the rule of law in Lebanon, supporting the reassertion of Syrian control, or otherwise contributing to Syrian interference in Lebanon, or infringing upon or undermining Lebanese sovereignty, to have materially assisted, sponsored, or provided financial, material, or technological support for, or goods or services in support of such action, including acts of violence, or any person whose property and interest in property are blocked pursuant to this order, to be a spouse or dependent child, and so forth. It's a precedent, Jerry, it seems to me. I mean, if you don't have to have taken any act, but you merely provide material assistance or sponsoring some kind of support for a policy that differs from the government's policy regarding Lebanon, and you can have your property confiscated, that's pretty intimidating.
Well, it certainly is. It's surprising that, to me anyway, Jim, that we as a society are sitting back and allowing these erosions to our civil rights and to the thwarting of the Constitution and particularly the Bill of Rights in the Constitution with surprisingly little protest. And that leads us, I think, to the bill that passed the House of Representatives in October that carries the title, the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007. And what jumps out at you right away with respect to that bill, and it's not a law as yet, it's we would still refer to it as a bill, because it only passed in the House and has not yet passed in the Senate. However, that's not to say that a great deal of comfort should be taken from that, because it passed in the House with a vote of over 435 congressional representatives in favor of it.
Yeah, and that's really stunning, Jerry, because this is a law against having impure thoughts, you know, in the language of the Catholic Church. I mean, I used to have a girlfriend who would tell me when she was young that she never knew what to do when going to confession, so she decided that the best thing she could do, you know, to have something to confess was to tell the priest that she had had impure thoughts. And I always thought that was very amusing, you know, that you'd be told to say so many Hail Marys or so many rosaries and all this. But what we're talking about here is a whole magnitude, giant steps upward in terms of seriousness and consequentiality. It's really stunning.
It is stunning, and there are some very odd things about this bill. I think during the course of this discussion, Jim, let me just sort of mention the topics on this bill that I think would be of interest to your listeners.
I wish you would, Jerry.
The first would be the terms, the definition of the two terms, one being, quote, radicalization, and the other being homegrown terrorism. I think we should probably discuss those definitions and see where that takes us. And then ultimately, I think your listeners are also going to probably want to know whether a bill like this would likely violate the Constitution. And I think we can discuss that a little bit. And then we should also, I think, discuss the background of the 15 sponsors of this bill. There's something weird going on here that I really just can't quite get my finger on it. And I think one way to sort of call attention to what I'm calling the weirdness about this bill, Jim, is to take a look at the background of the 15 sponsors. Then, time permitting, you know, I think there have been a couple of recent comments made by influential people with respect to the 9/11 truth movement, one of them being Bill Clinton and the other being Tucker Carlson. And what I think we have reason to be concerned about here is that it seems possible that there are those who are trying to label 9/11 truthers as people who are somehow both radical and violent, and you know where that leads. And that part of the discussion, I think, should come after we start by going through that series of things, starting with the definitions.
Well, I think that's good. I'll just say, Jerry, having lived 19 of the last 20 years in Minnesota, I was stunned that Bill Clinton would be in Minneapolis and saying, in response to a question about 9/11, "How dare you for suggesting the government might have been involved? How dare you?"
Yeah, exactly. And the reason why we dare is that the evidence strongly supports the claim
right.
that 9/11 was an inside job for all the reasons that we've discussed. That's how dare us.
We dare because it appears to be true.
Exactly. And but to take umbrage with something like that on such a presumptuous basis, with an indicator that, you know, something is amiss in our society,
well,
Jim.
It disillusioned me about Bill Clinton, I'll tell you. I never felt I had serious reason to doubt his integrity and character, apart from, in retrospect, you know, his support for NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, which I think is a calamity for the United States and the middle class and the working people of this country. But when he said that, when he made that remark, Jerry, I realized this was not the man I had thought he was.
I agree, Jim. There's, you know, something is amiss with that comment. Well, let me, the definition of violent radicalization under this thought crimes bill, H.R. 1955, is as follows. Quote, "The term violent radicalization means the process of adopting or promoting an extremist belief system for the purpose of facilitating ideologically based violence."
Adopting or promoting a belief system, Jerry. I mean, who's to judge what's extreme or not extreme? I think that those of the neocons are about as extreme as they could be. Stand by. We'll be right back to continue our discussion with Jerry Liepart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest this hour is Jerry Liepart, an activist, civil rights trial lawyer, and a bar member in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And we're talking about what was originally named House Resolution 1955, the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007, which has to be one of the greatest affronts to the Constitution in American legislative history. Jerry?
Indeed. Let me rattle off these two definitions, Jim, because they set a frame of reference for discussing this constitutional outrage. Violent radicalization means the process of adopting or promoting an extremist belief system for the purpose of facilitating ideologically based violence to advance political, religious, or social change. Now, in defense, you know, if we are to assume, Jim, that this outrage might be directed towards, say, activists for 9/11 truth, or people who are seeking to reassert the Constitution, who are claiming that the United States has been taken over by elements who are imposing a fascist system of government, et cetera, and so forth, then the key thing that we would use to defend against any such charges is to make sure that our opposition is rooted in nonviolence. What they try to do with legislation like this in order to have it pass muster is say that they are only advancing public safety and preventing people from inciting or engaging in violence. Now, right away, you know, a thought crime or anything that imposes a limitation upon speech, as this act surely does, it means that it is constitutionally suspect and would very likely have to undergo a review based on what's called the strict scrutiny standard. That's a hard standard to meet for purposes of constitutionality, but with the legal system being what it is these days, one has to assume that no matter, you know, how strict that standard may be or how hard it may be for legislation that imposes restrictions on people's freedoms to pass such a test, that this law might do so. Now, one reason why I think it's so blatantly unconstitutional is that it targets social change. Now, the concept of violence attaches to social stability or to social conservatism or to social reactionary ism just as much as it does to the concept of change. You see, the change is an element of the progressive side of the political equation, whereas maintaining the status quo is an element on the conservative side of the political equation. But as you look at this definition of violent radicalization, nowhere does it even mention issues that involve the conservative side of the political spectrum, which can be and has been as violent and, if anything, far, far more violent in U.S. history than has any activity on the social change, the progressive, or the radical side of the political equation. So right away, this law is unconstitutional, because it only targets a certain aspect of political thought that could or might conceivably somehow result in violence. Now, and this is...
It's like a lot of could just at the libertarian, for example.
Yeah, just at the libertarians. It doesn't apparently have any truck or any problem whatsoever with violence associated with maintaining the social status quo. That's absurd. However, it is also highly indicative of the unconstitutionality and of the blatant violation of rights that this legislative proposal contains. Now, earlier I said that there was some strangeness here, and what I find strange about this, Jim, is that if you take a look at the list of the 15 sponsors of this legislation, it includes 11 who are members of the Democratic branch of the one-party system, and only 4 members of the Republican branch of the one-party system. And what I also find rather odd is that among the Democrats, some of them come from and represent liberal areas, including the suburbs of New York City. There's a Rhode Island congressman who, Democratic congressman, who sponsors this bill. And there are 4 members of the Congressional Black Caucus who signed on as sponsors of this bill.
What's going on there, Jerry?
I have got to find out. I'm now becoming interested in how something like this could have come about with that group of sponsors. It also includes the congressional representative from the U.S. Virgin Islands, who is a non-voting member of Congress. But, you know, what on earth would provoke a citizen of the Virgin Islands to sponsor something like this? What on earth would motivate three other members of the Congressional Black Caucus to sponsor a bill like this? What would motivate someone who represents, a New England, a liberal New England state, to sponsor something like this? I think at the very least, we have got to ask these congressional representatives whether or not there's something in the water that they drink. Because they're obviously not only not being responsive to the public that they represent, but they're doing things that are almost 180 degrees opposed. Today, this hour, my special guest is Jerry Liepart, an activist civil rights trial lawyer and bar member in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and we're discussing a piece of legislation that is about as stunning as they get, a thought crimes prevention bill. Jerry, please continue. Okay, Jim. We've outlined what this bill seeks to do, namely to impose limitations upon speech and upon thought, almost exclusively geared by the language of the bill towards one part of the political thought spectrum, arguably to the exclusion of the other. Now, that is not to say that if it were more balanced in its attack upon freedom, that it would be okay. It's not, but it's just a measure of the absurdity of this legislation that it's so obvious in the way that it does that. Now, as a community whose members, might conceivably, come under the negative aspects of, this proposed legislation if it goes through, we do have to think in terms of, of how to defend ourselves. And one of the ideas that, that comes to mind is that, we on the progressive side do not often stake our claim on the flag in the way that the right wing and the neoconservative movement does. They are very quick to raise or wave the flag around.
Yes.
And it's flag waving is not something I think that comes naturally to libertarian or to progressive people, but we may have to start standing up for the flag, and we may have to start wearing those things on our shirts our lapels.
When I came on the O'Reilly show, he spent the first couple of minutes attacking me for hating my country as though it were impossible to distinguish between loving your country and hating an administration that would so pervert its values and its traditions.
Exactly, but you see what they do. There's a subtle trick that is being used successfully again and again, I'm afraid, and that is they stake out a claim to the flag. And you know what? Sometimes in just discussions like that when you're on the air, Jim, you may have to just say, take off that flag. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to me just as much.
I like that, Jerry. I like that a lot.
You just may have to start doing that.
I did have to confront you.
As mentioned in an earlier segment, make sure that your advocacy is rooted in nonviolence.
Yes.
Not calling for violence.
Well, I did have to confront him later in the program. I mean, when he was impugning my patriotism as a former Marine Corps officer, and I guarantee you Bill O'Reilly never spent a day in the service of his country.
Well, that's right. And that's another part of taking ownership in the country and not letting it be usurped by the right wing, those people who are jingoistic and who are so quick to say that, you know, they are standing up for the country, when upon scrutiny, what they're doing is they're subverting it. And you have to let them know that that is what they're doing, and that we, in fact, have a stake in this claim, in the flag that is equal or greater than theirs, based upon the horrific results that have befallen this country while they have been in power.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. I could imagine if this legislation were to pass, Jerry, that they conduct a massive sweep, and those of us who are out there expressing our opinions and generating criticism of the government could be, you know, ensnared in that huge sweep and put into those detention facilities they've already had constructed by Halliburton subsidiaries and for which the Congress has appropriated the money.
Well, you know, this the H.R. 1955, the Violent Radicalization Thought Crimes Act, actually only establishes a commission and doles out, you know, some positions, some paid positions, staffing, coming under the overall auspices of the Homeland Security Department, which is the direct successor to the old House Un-American Activities Committee.
That's right. That's correct.
And what they will do is they will engage in a study to see the extent to which, quote, violent radicalization and, quote, homegrown terrorism is taking place. And their mandate is not to violate the constitutional rights of citizens. The bill is absurd on its face. It's woefully inconsistent and incoherent internally, all of which means it's likely to pass.
Right, because those who don't like one side of it can always find the contradictory other side.
Right. So, I suggest looking at the list of sponsors. For those of your listeners who, you know, might live in one of the congressional districts of the sponsors and who might want to engage in correspondence with that congressional representative concerning what were they thinking. The list includes Representative Christopher Carney, Democrat of Pennsylvania, Donna Christensen, Democrat of the Virgin Islands, about whom I spoke earlier, Yvette Clark, Democrat of New York, Charles Dent, Republican of Pennsylvania, Norman Dix, Democrat of Washington, Al Green, Democrat of Texas, James Langevin, Democrat of Rhode Island, Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California, Nita Lowey, Democrat of New York, very near New York City, Daniel Lundgren, Republican of California, Ed Perlmutter, Democrat of Colorado, Ted Poe, Republican of Texas, David Reichert, Republican of Washington, and Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi. Any of your listeners live in any of the districts of any of those named sponsors, I recommend that they be contacted. Something else that the 9/11 Truth Movement may have to do is it may have to figure out how to coalesce and start running candidates, for various offices, because this 1.5 party system,
yes,
it's just it's another disgrace. I mean, they would have 11 of 15 sponsors of a thought crimes bill come from the seemingly liberal, quote-unquote, whatever that might mean in the U.S., side of the Democratic Party is simply incongruent. You know, so something is amiss when something like that happens. Who is giving direction to these congressional representatives to do things like that?
I think that the huge outpouring for Ron Paul is an expression of the quest for authenticity, you know. I mean, he has a very mixed bag of positions across the board when you stop and look at it, but his outspoken opposition to the war and desire to bring the troops home and his support for the Constitution make him so much more authentic than any other candidate out there that the people are responding. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Jerry Liepart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, I'm concluding the second hour with my special guest, Jerry Liepart, an activist civil rights attorney who is been admitted to the bar in three states and who has been offering his observations about this thought crime prevention bill. And I just noticed, Jerry, in an article about it that I have archived on the Scholars website, 911scholars.org, under the date of 25 October, in the last paragraph, the observation is made that the biggest joke of all is that this section also says that any measure to prevent violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism should not violate the constitutional rights of citizens, even though the definition of violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism as they are defined are themselves unconstitutional.
Exactly, Jim. That's one of those inconsistencies, incongruities, that this bill is filled with. I know we're in our last segment, Jim, and thinking about how those who question 9/11 have recently come under this orthodox attack by people like Bill Clinton and Tucker Carlson. Carlson is said to have said, I have to put it that way because I do not allow myself ever to watch or listen to anything on mainstream media. I only can get that secondhand because it's toxic and I don't expose myself to it.
Tell me about Tucker. What happened on Tucker?
He said, quote, if you really believe the U.S. government killed 3,000 of its own citizens for no reason and lied about it and invaded Afghanistan as a result, et cetera, and so forth, he concluded by saying, if you believe that, you ought to leave. And the answer to that is no, we stay.
Yes.
And we restore the Constitution and we bring to account those, be they within or without the government, who did that. That is what we do.
I absolutely agree, Jerry. You stand and you fight for your country and your principles and what you believe in. And I just observed that what Tucker was saying is incoherent on its face. He says killed 3,000 civilians for no reason, and then he says invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. But, of course, that was the rationale. It was used as the rationale to justify the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. So,
he's actually half right in the sense that the inferences that you draw from what was done and what 9/11 was used for is simply horrific. It is the worst false flag operation in our history and one of the worst false flag operations in recorded history. It is a stunning crime. It is an unprecedented crime. It is a worse war crime and crime against humanity than is the unlawful invasion of Iraq. Now, these are things that people need to say, and these are platforms that people need to run on. And these are things that are not ever spoken of, mentioned, or even hinted at on mainstream media.
Well, it's interesting you raise the prospect of 9/11 candidates running for office because Kevin Barrett is planning to run here in Wisconsin for the House of Representatives. And I think it's an excellent idea because it creates a platform for the discussion of these issues. I mean, win, lose, or draw, you've actually gained an opportunity to present arguments and issues that the press wouldn't cover were you anyone else than an actual candidate for a high office.
It's legal process. As you know, I represent Dr. Judy Wood and Dr. Morgan Reynolds and Mr. Edward Haas, citizens taking legal action. out the truth of 9/11. We must do these things. These are lawful things to do, as is running for office on this platform that we have been talking about. That's not radical. It has nothing whatever, by any stretch of the imagination, implied or otherwise, direct or indirect, to do with violence. It has everything to do with lawful process that citizens can and should engage in, especially now.
Well, Jerry, I can't tell you how much I admire your thoughtful approach to all these issues and the use of the Data Quality Act and the contrivance of these key TAM lawsuits. I think it's absolutely stunning, and it has a really the effect of a battering ram, it seems to me, to break down the doors to the castle that has been protecting artificially the administration from the force of truth.
Well, it's the old saying, the pen is mightier than the sword. And I do urge people to put down their swords and pick up their pens.
And here I would just encourage, listeners who aren't aware to go to 911scholars.org and review our last few press releases, which concern many of these key issues, where Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds and Ed Haas have, with Jerry's assistance, brought these lawsuits in the name of the United States, by the way. I mean, this is a case where if the government is in essence derelict in its duty, a citizen can step into the breach and can bring a suit in the name of the United States to bring about the right kind of resolution of an issue where justice has been obstructed or the truth has not been pursued in an appropriate fashion.
That's right, where fraud has been committed, and Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds are suing on behalf of the United States of America.
And in my opinion, that makes them among the greatest patriots of our day, Jerry. I just say they're standing up for the United States and the principles and values for which it is supposed to stand in the face of an administration so corrupt that it bears comparison to those of the Third Reich and Benito Mussolini and other tyrants of the recent past.
They have committed war crimes and need to be held account. And what we need to conclude by saying is that anyone who unwittingly accepts the current version of what passes for truth unquestioningly is doing this country a grave disservice, and they ought to reconsider.
And I must say, Jerry, it's a small group who historically has been responsible for making the great strides in science and technology, and I dare say here, with respect to unveiling the truth about 9/11, and I'm just very proud to be associated with persons like you and Judy and Morgan, Ed Haas, and others who are making such magnificent contributions. Ace Baker obviously deserves prominent mention in that group.
Indeed. And our suggestion to Tucker Carlson is that, no, we stay, you leave. And with respect to Mr. Bill Clinton, I think an apology is in order to those people in Minnesota who he questioned in a way that put them in a very defensive and vulnerable position. If you sort of read the subtitles of what Bill Clinton was saying about the people in Minnesota, he concluded by saying, you're giving Minnesota a bad name. Well, Bill Clinton, what exactly did you mean by that? Are you accusing those people of a thought crime, Bill Clinton?
Yes.
Oh, how dare you?
Yes. Jerry Liebhart, activist attorney, you're doing such good work, my friend. My hat is off to you. I salute you. Keep it up, my friend, and thank you for coming on the show. I look forward to having you back. Meanwhile, for all of you who have been listening, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thank you.